And somber few days at WHYY since the death of our colleague Tony Auth, who had been diagnosed with cancer a few years ago. He was 72 years old. Tony was digital artist in residence at the station after more than four decades as editorial cartoonist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he won a number of prestigious awards. At a time when most people retire or wind down their careers, Tony embraced his new job at the station and all that this new technology offered him as a cartoonist, illustrator, and storyteller. Reading the obituaries and articles written about Tony Auth in the last 36 hours, there are certain themes that emerge. How much he loved his family, his wife Eliza and their two daughters, what a good friend he was, how passionate he was about his work, how generous he was to others in his field, his extraordinary gifts as a cartoonist, of course, and the optimism embedded in his drawings exposing political hypocrisy, corruption, and stupidity. Well, today on Radio Times, we celebrate Tony Auth with his friends and colleagues, and let me introduce them to you. David Leopold is author and curator, in fact, organized to stir, inform, and inflame the art of Tony Auth that was at the Michener Museum just a few years ago. Also edited the companion book of cartoons for Camino Press. And there's an exhibition currently at the Philadelphia Foundation called Frontlines, Treasures from the Tony Auth Archive, organized by David Leopold. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Rick Nichols, former food writer and member of the Philadelphia Inquirer editorial board. He's an adjunct lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. Rick Nichols, nice to have you with us as well.
How are you, Marty?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And rounding out our trio of guests is Chris Cetullo, WHYY's Vice President for News and Civic Engagement. And Chris worked as editorial page editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer and worked with Tony Auth. And Chris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
as
well.
Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about Tony Auth. Chris, you had a really beautiful piece about Tony yesterday, and you talked about the kind of joy of him, of knowing him, of his work. Can you expand on that for us?
Sure. I don't think I've ever worked with anybody who loved what he did more than Tony and was more open about just sort of conveying that to everybody around him. One of my favorite moments every morning when we were at the Inquirer together, and Rick remembers this well, was, you know, after the editorial board meeting, Tony would go into his studio and start sketching ideas for cartoons. And he'd usually have either two or three different ideas or two or three different versions of the sketches. And then he would walk around the entire building. He had this rota of people. Rick was on it. I was on it. He would go through the newsroom, and everybody would just look up, and he'd have this grin on his face. I've got an idea. What do you think? But he really wanted to hear what other people thought. But he just sort of walked around spreading, like, isn't it great that we get to do this every day? That's who he was to work with.
Yeah, you want to add to that, Rick?
Well, he did want to hear what other people thought, but if you challenged him, he wanted to hear your objections dissected. He wasn't going to take it laying down. So he really had to, you know, you really had to defend your position. You couldn't just say, well, I don't think
The one thing Tony never did was take somebody else's idea for a cartoon entire, but he would change what he would do based on the feedback.
I think during his whole career, I might have gotten two that were roughly, you know, I had something to.
That's pretty good. I was his boss and I got zero.
Well, you, David, you come at this differently in that you didn't work with Tony in a newsroom, but you have looked through all of his work.
Well, I had an interesting relationship with him in the fact that I looked through everything that he had done and we had this vocabulary that we shared with each other about his drawings and about the drawings that influenced him and the artists that influenced him. I came at it more from an art angle. And, of course, that's what Tony was as an artist. I mean, he uses his art to tell a message as a weapon. And what I learned, you know, they look so easy. You know, that's one of the reasons why they stick around in our minds so long is because they're so direct and powerful, but they're not easy at all. When he would send me sketches, you know, via email and say, what do you think?
Yeah.
And I would think, how do you improve this? And of course, he always would by the time he got the cartoon done.
Well, Chris, what I found so incredible, and I was a fan of Tony Auth when I would read the Inquirer, sort of see, and this was 5 days a week, so what did Tony Auth have for the paper? But he made this extraordinary transition to radio and had such a great radio presence and voice.
Right. Well, I told him very early on after he got to WHYY that I hated him because he made the transition easier than I did. He would do audio for his animations or just go out and do interviews, and we started calling him One Take Tony because he never needed to redo anything. He got it perfect the first time, had a great voice. But what he really loved was in the digital sphere being able to move to animation, to create cartoons that moved and spoke, and that he was just in love with the possibilities there. And one of the sad things is that he didn't get to explore them as greatly as he wanted to.
Did you want to add something?
Yeah, he really opened up a whole new world for cartoonists. I mean, the fraternity of editorial cartoonists has always been small and has only gotten smaller. But Chris bringing him over to WHYY was something that the people across the country took notice of. And the animations that he did on his iPad really showed a new way for cartooning to be done in a digital format. And it is a crime that he wasn't allowed to explore those, because if you look at them on the WHYY website, on the NewsWorks website, and on Tony's Behind the Lines blog, you really realize, wow, this was he was doing great work. And it wasn't political work. It was much more cultural work. And it was an exciting avenue for him to explore.
I want to play a little clip. I interviewed Tony Oth. I think it was his first day on the job here at WHYY. In fact, I'd interviewed him a number of times over the years, and this is a story that he's told a number of times, but I think it's worth telling again, which is when he was a kid. He was diagnosed with rheumatic fever or something like that, and spent a lot of time, he was 5 years old, spent a lot of time in bed, and his mom did something pretty extraordinary.
Well, I was diagnosed as having rheumatic fever, and there seems to be some question about whether that was a good diagnosis at this point, because, you know, they know so much more now. I don't remember really being sick. What I remember is having to stay in bed all the time.
Wow. For a five-year-old.
Well, yeah, I missed kindergarten, but it was the golden age of radio, and I was listening to the radio all the time. And then my mother walked in one day with crayons, pencils, papers, and stuff, and said, "You really should learn how to draw." I said, "Okay, Mom." And
did she know something about you?
I don't know. And I often wonder, had this all not happened, would I have fallen in love with drawing like I did very quickly? I just don't know.
Rick, any thoughts about that? I'm sure you've heard that story before,
I've heard that story before, and I think it probably continues in that interview, is that he fell in love not just with radio, but these serials on the radio, sort of Sky King and Superman and the superheroes. And as I remember it, he started to sort of imitate those in his drawings. And I've seen other cartoonists do that. Jeff McNally was sort of used to copy Mad Magazine in his early career. But so I think that Tony had these models, and you could even see some of that kind of adventure stuff, adventure comics in his later work, where he's with airplanes and, sailing ships and pirates.
Yeah, and he loved pirates, yeah. Chris. What was this pirate thing?
Well, he loved pirates, he loved Vikings, and, the other thing, he used to listen to, Flash Gordon and
Lone Ranger.
And so he remained a fanboy of NASA and space exploration. That was one of the things where we tended to disagree with him a little bit on the editorial board, like, down with the Mars bit, Tony. We're not going to Mars anytime soon. But you could see that, from that boy who was five, just that fascination with exploration, space travel, crossing oceans. He was a huge sailor, so he loved pirates, he loved Vikings, he loved all of that.
Go ahead, David.
And he was always curious. I think that's really, science was really his second great love. And he was always wanting to learn more and to explore what was happening. And I think that shows through in his work, because he has a constantly curious mind.
Well, what's so interesting, too, is that he began as a medical illustrator. And I wonder, back to you, David, whether, you see that in his drawings, the way he would draw people, for instance.
Well, what I see in his drawings is an artist who's responding to the story that he's telling rather than having a style that was the same in every drawing. He didn't do just the same thing. He didn't do a whimsical drawing when he was talking about, say, death in Gaza or something like that. What he did is the message told what the kind of drawing that he was going to do.
You were both members of the editorial board at the Philadelphia Inquirer. To you, Rick Nichols, so what was the role that Tony played there, Tony Oth?
Well, Tony, you know, was a full-fledged member. I mean, I think some editorial boards, maybe the cartoonist is off, you know, on an ivory tower, maybe not even on premises. But Tony, and Chris has mentioned this in some of his work, Tony loved the rough and tumble. He loved being in the arena, and he would join in our arguments. We actually, Chris was there. I was there at a certain era. I overlapped with Chris, but we went through several iterations of from Ed Guthman, who was very Tony-friendly, to an editor after him who was not too happy
not so
with
Tony's
philosophy. Yeah. And honest to God, many of Tony's cartoons came right out of those editorial board meetings as sort of graphic rebuttals to what the prevailing philosophy was of the day. I mean, and doors were slamming and things were, it could be pretty.
What do you remember, Chris?
Well, exactly what Rick said. You know, the question of controversy and the fact that Tony never shied away from it. And the only time I think once talked Tony out of a cartoon or like basically called him up and said, we actually don't want to publish this. It was a Middle Eastern cartoon that had been overtaken by events. I think there'd been a bombing in Jerusalem or somewhere in Israel. And the cartoon just seemed like it would be really a disaster. But most of the time he would come in and I would look at him and I'd say, you really want to do this? You really, really want to do this? Because here's like what I see as the potential reaction. And he would say, yeah, I want to do it. And so that was the relationship we had. It was my job. Every once in a while, he'd say, maybe I'll tweak this or maybe we'll hold this off. But mostly he'd say, yeah, I want to do it. And that was my job to say. He was an independent commentator. You know, he wasn't an arm of the newspaper or the editorial board. But it was like, think about it. And he would think about it. Usually he'd want to go ahead.
I mean, did he welcome the criticism? Did he see that was part of his job as an editorial cartoonist?
I'd like to think he and I had that relationship. He hadn't had that with the predecessor who shall go unnamed, I guess.
He's in Bolivia now.
He
can't hurt us now.
I don't think he's listening.
He's in Bolivia.
But Tony appreciated somebody. He saw that I had his back, and I would tell him when he was going to get in deep hot water. Usually he would say, oh, let me dive in.
Go ahead.
I always thought Tony had the perfect job because if he succeeded, he pissed everybody off. But really what he was trying to go for was the truth. And if that upset people, then that upset people. We were just talking about this before. I think one of the reasons why we've been seeing this really outpouring of really love for Tony is because he did upset a lot of people. But for a lot of people, he was their voice. You know, they could open up the paper and he had summarized something that everybody understood.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Leopold. Also with us are Rick Nichols and Chris Satullo. We are remembering, celebrated the life and work of our friend and colleague, Tony Auth. He died on Sunday after a couple of year battle with cancer. We're going to take a very short break and then we're going to get Jules Pfeiffer in on the conversation. I spoke with him yesterday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
Next time in Studio 360, sometimes movies about science hit a little too close to home.
Watching Gwyneth Paltrow going into a seizure from a viral infection and then having a pathologist cut her skull open, that's pretty gutsy.
Our Viruses, Ourselves. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Paying a farmer in advance to get a share of his crops is a great way to get the freshest produce. But our resident chef, Kathy Gunn, says there are risks along with rewards.
If it's a really crummy season and there's no rain, let's say, you fall with the farmer.
That story next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from An Evening with David Sedaris, October 14th at the Merriam Theater. NPR personality and best-selling author David Sedaris will host a night of new readings, recollections, and a book signing. Tickets and information at KimmelCenter.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Leopold. He's an author, curator. Also with us, Rick Nichols, former food writer and member of the editorial board of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Chris Cetullo, also a former member of the editorial board at the Inquirer, currently WHYY's vice president for news and civic engagement. And we are talking about our friend and colleague, Tony Auth. Again, died on Sunday. He worked here. He was also at the Inquirer. And has many friends and colleagues who have much to say about him. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Well, Jules Pfeiffer was a longtime friend of Tony Auth. He wrote the foreword to the book, The Art of Tony Auth, to stir, inform, and inflame. He said, quote, his self-assigned mission was to be smart with a heart. I spoke with Jules Pfeiffer yesterday about his relationship with Tony Auth. So, Jules Pfeiffer, what was it like to be a friend of Tony Auth?
It was fun. It was fun. It was noisy. There's an element, I say is because it's hard to put Tony in the past tense, an element of swashbuckle about him, and as there is swashbuckle about me, so we love to sit often in bars and swashbuckle at each other talk and laugh and sometimes discuss serious subjects, but even discussing serious subjects, he could be funny about it, and I could be funny about it. We loved to go over issues and outrages and comment on them and bolster each other's morale, which is what we did because we felt a strong collegiality in terms of our work and in terms of our lives.
So when you look at Tony Auth's drawings and cartoons, and he did so many of them, what do you see in them that is so Tony Auth?
Well, for one thing, he was a thinking man's cartoonist. The sort of work increasingly being done in the last generation or more is gag strips posing as editorial cartoons, the kind of talk show, a monologue material that one gets, and the crack about this side and the crack about that side, but never knowing or caring to know the politics of the person talking or any thought behind it. Tony's mind was analytical. Tony did homework and loved to do homework, and it wasn't only about politics he was interested in. So he was wide-ranging and analytical and thoughtful, and he wanted to have the reader go away not just with the shock of a political cartoon, but to make him or her think about something, and I think he often did that. And I think he often changed people's mind or helped change minds, and of course he outraged them, which is what the job is all about.
He really, it was so clear, both as someone who read him and got to know him and interviewed him on Radio Times, he loved what he was doing.
He was a happy dissident. You know, he loved to lay waste, but it gave him great pleasure, and there was not a destructive bone in his body. He was a very moral, but not self-righteous man. He really cared about people. I think he was happy. I mean, he had a wonderful marriage and children, and he was doing the work that he thought as many of us do when we are allowed to do our work that we care about. He was doing work that he was meant to do, and he couldn't be happier doing it.
He seemed to also find that, maybe it is a fine line, I'm not sure, but certainly a line between the outrage that you need to be a political cartoonist or editorial cartoonist and the mean-spiritedness that people often have.
Well, Tony could be mean, but he was not mean-spirited. There wasn't a mean-spirited bone in his body. He had a generous, open nature, but he could get truly pissed off about certain issues, and he would take off on those. And those were issues almost always, I would say, I take away the almost there, that always needed to be defined, and they had to be talked about. And very often, they were the subjects that conventional wisdom had got wrong, and Tony was there to tell them where, how they got it wrong.
I must say, reading all the articles and obituaries that have been written about Tony Off today, there are several different themes. One of them is just his generous nature, what a good friend he was, and also how he helped others, especially other political cartoonists. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, it's, you know, he did, and other cartoonists have done. It's what the good people do. And Tony was a good person. It's what Tony did to everyone who crossed his path, but it's also what Paul Conrad, the great cartoonist for the L.A. Times, did. It's what others have done. You see colleagues or young people or others who come to you for guidance or your path crosses, and it's just natural to want to increase the fraternity. The fraternity of political cartoonists has been narrowing and narrowing and narrowing almost to the point of disappearance for many years. And as narrow as that is, the good ones are fewer and further between. So if you can find people who of talent, who you think have a chance and deserve to be heard, of course you encourage them. And Tony didn't envy the opposition. He wanted to encourage it. He loved talk. He loved debate. He loved argument. But another thing that's to say about him, he was a wonderful family man. He was a devoted father and husband. And along with that, he loved writing and drawing about children. His children's book work, which is underseen and underappreciated, is some of the best work anybody's done in that field. And pirate ships talking about pirates and drawing pirates was something that gave him great joy, and he gave wonderful representation of that. I'm told that as he was dying, Eliza, his wife, read to him from Treasure Island, which gave him great pleasure.
Oh, that's beautiful. How will you then remember Tony Off?
As a complete person, as a great friend, primarily, as one who made me very happy every time I saw him, as somebody who I'd love to sit and talk to for hours, he, Eliza, and myself, and was always surprised by what came up. Anything came up, and we talked, we laughed, we yelled. He was one of those rare people in life who comes into your life and, in a sense, never leaves it. So while Tony is gone, he's really not gone at all. He will always be with me.
Well, Jules Pfeiffer, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and memories about Tony Off. Thank you very much.
It's very much my pleasure.
And that was Jules Pfeiffer speaking yesterday about his friend and colleague, Tony Off. And again, I'm joined with joined by Chris Cetullo, Rick Nichols, and David Leopold. And any questions or comments to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Chris, I would have loved to have been on that bar stool next to Jules Pfeiffer and Tony Off, swashbuckling, as he just said, and arguing
right.
about whatever.
Well, not too long ago, Dave and I had the opportunity to do that. I think David's done it a number of times.
You swashbuckled.
Well, we had an event here at WHYY that meant a lot to Tony around the opening of the David's exhibit as when it was here at WHYY, and Jules came in a limousine with very many specific instructions about what needed to be in the back of the limousine.
That's why they invented radio.
But yeah. So they went out and did just a wonderful job of just dazzling people for an hour and a half, talking about some of the things we've been talking about. Then we went out drinking afterwards, and I got to see
you. Got to swashbuckle.
Well, I don't know how much swashbuckling I did, but it's hard to keep up with those two old dudes. They could really party.
David, it looks like you want to say something.
Oh, well, you know, Jules was almost a generation older than Tony. And Tony was, I mean, Jules is the one who opened the door for so many political cartoonists in addressing a whole range of options. Because Tony didn't just do cartoons about political leaders, but he did a lot of cartoons about us, about people on the street, people, things that he saw going on in everyday life. But he made friends with Jules and Herb Bloch, who and Paul Conrad, who really gave him his first advice when Paul died, they went to Tony to give the eulogy because they had become such good friends. And Tony passed that on. Jake Tapper, we don't think of as a great editorial cartoonist, but he mentored him when Jake wanted to be an editorial cartoonist. Signe Wilkerson will tell you the same thing. So many people, and I've seen it over the last 36 hours, 48 hours, so many people tweeting and writing on message boards about how they went in to see Tony, and Tony couldn't have been nicer to them and treated them like an equal rather than a novice.
In fact, let me quote something. Signe Wilkerson said, this was in the Washington Post yesterday, she said, Tony relished cartooning. He loved the drawing, the politics, and the phone calls afterwards. He also relished egging on other cartoonists, including young ones starting out, including me. She goes on to say, I walked into his office with a putrid portfolio, and he treated me like I was already one of the gang. It's one of the many reasons he's admired in the cartoon fraternity. Just picking up on what you said.
Well, I can remember the late 80s. Tony and I were down in Nicaragua. We were in Managua one night, and after our tour of our fact-finding mission, as it were, we ended up at a bar called Antojitos and, you know, had a little bit of rum, Flor de Caña. And Tony was encouraging a young cartoonist there. His name was Roher, who worked for Barricada, the Sandinista newspaper. And as Tony would often do, when people save these, he was drawing, sketching stuff on napkins. And he did a picture of Reagan with a big 10-gallon hat and six guns dragging on the floor, very bellicose. This is during the Contra War. The next day, that napkin art was half the front page of Barricada, the Sandinista newspaper. And the story goes on from there. But, you know, that just shows, you know, his encouragement and alcohol probably don't necessarily mix.
Let me just make a couple of notes here. One, if you want to check out Tony's work, and there's Newsworks has built a whole sort of tribute to Tony at his blog. It's called
Behind the Lines.
Behind the Lines. So if you go to Newsworks, go to Tony's blog, go to Behind the Lines, and you can check it out. Also, Frontlines, and that's Treasures from the Tony Auth Archive, is currently at the Philadelphia Foundation. That's at 1234 Market Street. And David, you're part of that as well.
I am. When I went in to first see Tony's work, I've had the good fortune of going into a lot of great artists and newspaper artists. Archives, for lack of a better word, because they don't really have them. And the great ones, Al Hirschfeld, David Levine, and they had a lot of stuff. Tony is the first person, the first artist of that stature who had virtually everything.
He
kept everything because he was more interested in doing than in selling it or doing anything else with it. He had five cartoons to do a week, and in one year he did a daily comic strip with Daniel Pinkwater, and he did 11 children's books. And as anybody will tell you, he seemed to be always ready to go out and have a drink or stay with a friend or talk with a friend. And I'm not exactly sure when he got time to do everything, but fortunately, he kept everything, and the archive of his work reveals it's his history, but it's our history as well. It's the last 50 years.
Wow.
Because while he was in Philadelphia for 43 years, you have given another 6 years because he started out in Los Angeles. And it's an amazing thing that not only can tell us about our past, but some of these cartoons seem like they were done yesterday. And I've often said some of them seem like they could be done tomorrow. There are very timeless cartoons, and it's what I picked for the exhibitions, ones that don't require explanations. You know, here they are 25, 30 years later, and they don't require an explanation because he got it.
Yeah, and as a viewer, you get it as well, yeah. Obviously.
And just so I'm going to make a pitch here, people can – that archive is one of those things that we don't want to see broken up, that we don't want to see any place other than Philadelphia. And the way to do that is the exhibition over at the Philadelphia Philadelphia Foundation, was to kick off a fund, the Tony Auth Archive Fund, to keep to acquire that work and maintain it over at Temple University. And you can do that by going to the Philadelphia Foundation website. I think there's even links on the WHYY tribute page. So I encourage people to do that. If you love Tony's work, you've been inspired by it, by he was your voice, this is your chance to repay that.
I want to play another clip from an interview I did with Tony a couple of years ago, because both you, Rick, and you, Chris, referenced the newsroom. I mean, how important it was to have him there. Let me just play. It's a short clip. Let's listen.
Over the years, people have said, oh, you can work at home. How lucky you are. I would never do that.
Because you would miss all the brouhaha.
Well, and you need to bounce your ideas off people, get feedback, respond. Collaboration is a stimulus and a catalyst to artistic activity.
You saw that here too, didn't you, Chris?
Absolutely. The last couple of years at the Enquirer were a little tough for Tony. It was a tough environment for a lot of people. Coming here, he was energized by the new opportunities in digital art, but he was also energized by being in our newsroom full of young people who were not as jaded or beaten down as some of the people he'd been working with. And they just adored the man. I mean, it was really beautiful to see. You have to tell them to stop calling him Mr. Auth. Some of them never quite learned that.
Right.
But yeah, it was something that was very lovely to see.
Let me get Chris from Rose Valley to join our conversation. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had the pleasure of working with Tony and his wife, Eliza, in the early 80s on a fundraising project that they pulled together, which was wonderful. Eliza was on the board of Philadelphia Committee for the Homeless, as it was then, and Tony very generously donated quite a bit of his work and, more important, assembled a lot of his friends from the cartooning and art world. And donated work to be auctioned in this cartoon auction, which was our major fundraiser for a couple of years. I think it really kept the organization afloat, and he was just a very gracious guy. And self-effacing might not be the right word, but certainly didn't hold himself above any of us or any of his fellow cartoonists.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call, and let me give it. Rick, do you want to respond to this?
It's interesting that you use the homeless issue or mention that. One of my favorite cartoons, and I think it's shown up in some of these posthumous reviews, is a fellow, a sort of down-and-out fellow, at a homeless encampment, asking for some space to lay his head down, and they say, "Oh no, this is the Veterans Affairs encampment, the homeless encampments over across the street," and that idea of Tony drawing those kind of disconnected things together, I think, is the thing of his. I don't want to say genius, but of his creativity. He had another cartoon. I'll just mention one other one that actually I looked at today and I went like, oh, my God. The veterans, the congressmen are standing there yelling at someone about why can't you keep up with the veterans problem? Get these things going. Meanwhile, with another hand, they're grinding this meat grinder that people are being fed into called Endless War. And I was like, oh, my God, yeah. Like, these holier-than-thou guys are the guys that are creating the problem up front. And, it takes a really creative mind to join those two together.
Indeed. And that's Rick Nichols, who joins us along with Chris Tatullo and David Leopold. We are talking about the life and work of our friend and colleague, Tony Auth. Much more after this very short break. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Turning Stone Choice supports WHYY, the TSC program designed to work with schools, parents, and communities to help young people live a life of inner fulfillment and help them feel more in control of their lives and the decisions they make. The program is not scripted and can be easily incorporated into daily life. The TSC program develops stronger critical thinking and choice-making skills in order for individuals to increase their self-esteem and build confidence. Information available at 800-723-5405 or turningstonechoice.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is about the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that was brokered by President Carter at Camp David. Wright is also the author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
One of the components in virtually all modern electronic gadgets, worker exploitation.
China had had to create some clinics just for the paralyzed teenagers and kids who'd fallen into comas from the toxic chemicals that they'd been exposed to in the factories.
The cost of being the manufacturing leader in electronics, a human cost in China. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, again talking about the life and work of our friend and colleague Tony Auth, who died on Sunday. And again, our guests are Chris Cetullo, Rick Nichols, and David Leopold. I do want to play another clip from an interview I did with Tony a couple of years ago when he first started here at WHYY. And this was about drawing George Herbert Walker Bush.
I remember George H.W. Bush. My first drawings of him were sort of failed attempts at realism. And then you could tell who it was, and you stick a label on it. But over time, the caricature takes on a life of its own and then takes off. And that's a joy when that happens. And pretty soon, you can take down the photographs of George H.W. Bush that you have on your little bulletin board to remind you what he looks like. You don't need that anymore because the caricature has really taken on a life of its own and is. And actually, the more distorted it gets, it's amazing, the more realistic it is.
That's so interesting. Hmm. And again, that's Tony Auth talking about his work. We were talking during the break here about Tony's politics, and we don't want people to sort of walk away with a wrong impression of him. Go ahead, Chris Cetullo.
Well, we're all a little concerned about leaving the impression of St. Tony, whom yes. Everyone loved. Tony, David chose well the word inflame for the title of the exhibit in the book. He did inflame people. There were people who considered him a doctrinaire liberal or even, worse, some kind of radical. The fathers of the Catholic Church probably, didn't have great feelings for him. Very often supporters of Israel felt that he wasn't quite up to snuff with that. But I'd also like to point out there were times when Tony, as a matter of principle, went against what you might think were his liberal proclivities. I can't remember, Rick, whether you were still on the board, then I'm sure we disagreed if you were. But around Clinton and the Lewinsky thing, Tony, and remember, he was the doting father of two beautiful daughters, felt very strongly about the Lewinsky case and thought that Clinton should resign over it, which was definitely not an opinion that sort of went with the liberal consensus in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Is that true? Go ahead, Rick.
Also, during the whole problems in apartheid South Africa, he drew a cartoon that showed African leaders reproving a white South African, holding an African resident by the neck, which would be where you might want to stop your cartoon. But while that was going on the other side, with them all turned facing South Africa, was Idi Amin beating the people of Uganda and absolute silence on that. So he was not in lockstep. That's why he was a cartoonist.
And though liberal in his politics, he was no friend of corruption if it came in Democratic clothes.
Yeah, of
he
course.
Was brutal on various mayors of Philadelphia.
And I just want to add this thing to Chris's comment that sometimes the fathers of the Catholic Church probably didn't agree with this thing. It wasn't just that. They would routinely denounce him by name from the pulpit on Sunday because of issues, because of his stands for abortion rights or what have you. So he was bête noire not just that group, but many other
groups. He was also very proud of being one of the three cartoonists on the NRA's enemies list.
But let me quote something he said. This is when he got the Herb Bloch Prize. This was 2005. And he said a lot of interesting things. One of them, in these times when those of us who are members of the reality-based community are under relentless attack from both the right and the left, we must encourage and our work must reflect independent and non-ideological thinking. So he had a point of view, but he wasn't, you know, he was willing to look. You're nodding your head, David.
Sure. You know, looking through 10,000 cartoons in a relatively short period of time, you know, themes come up what was amazing to me is how many times the same issue came up, different names, but the same issue came up. And I eventually went to him and said, because it was depressing me. I mean, I just was thinking, how do you do this year in, year out? And it's the same jerks out there. He said, oh, you got to be optimistic about it. You know, you got to hope that change, you know, change happens incrementally. But he wasn't, you know, he knew that he wasn't going to solve all the problems, but that didn't mean he was going to stop going to the barricades to try to do something about it.
We have a tweet from Chris Brennan, who writes for the Philadelphia Daily News, saying, Tony once noted it was ridiculous to eject a man from a free speech forum for asking a question, which I think sort of speak to what we were talking about, Chris.
Right. And, you know, the other thing about Tony, he had a long and complicated and often contentious history on the Middle East with both, you know, Palestinian organizations and Jewish organizations, you know, alternatively, and on one very famous occasion I remember on about the same cartoon, both storming in to have meetings with me and the editor of the paper, you know, one group calling him Zionist, the other calling him anti-Semitic for the same cartoon. But Tony would never turn down a speaking engagement. He loved the idea of going to talk to people whom he knew were upset with him and saying, you know, I know you're upset with me, and that's fine, but we can still talk. And he would pull that off over and over again.
Let me get Joan from Fort Washington to join our conversation. Hi, Joan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to express my appreciation for Tony off. Back in the mid-80s, I had called him in the fall to see if he would speak to a large parents group, school district parents group, and he had never done it and was reluctant. He said, call me back in April. So I did, April 1st, and he said, you're persistent, and he finally agreed to do it. And I think he was a bit nervous because this was the first time he was going to do something like this, and he gathered together a wonderful program of his cartoons and spoke to about 150 people, I think. Didn't charge us, as far as I recall. It was so gracious and so wonderful, and we so much appreciated his being here.
Well, Joan, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Just, I guess, I mean, we aren't, he's not St. Tony, but he had a lot of really very generous qualities. I think that's pretty obvious.
I'll just tell you one brief thing. I sent notes out to my sons, one in Washington, D.C., and one in Los Angeles. And when they were growing up, he would always do a birthday cartoon for them. And they're framed in their house. And now they have children. And when they were born, he did birthday cartoons for them. So they sent me little what do you call the photos? I photos of them on their walls, and they said that they were, you know, they were sort of going down the hallowed halls of Tony Auth. And I have to say that kind of broke me up a little bit.
Yeah. We have an email from Catherine saying, I loved his political point of view and skill in translating it to a cartoon on any given day, which affected everyone. His cartoons were so expressive. David, expressive.
Well, they were. They touched us in ways that and I have two members of the editorial board here, and they
on
are
either side of you, actually.
And they're wonderful writers. But the fact is, people remember the cartoons much, much longer than the text, because that's the nature of graphic commentary. When you do it right, it sears into your brain, and whether you want to remember it or not, it's like that song that won't go away in your head. They stick with you, and people who, you know, as I've seen, I've done these different exhibitions, and people come in, and all of a sudden they said, oh, I remember this one, and, you know, and it was 30 years old. You know, they have remembered it that long, and it becomes part of who they are.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Responding to what David said, you know, it's less true than it was, you know, alas and alack. But newspapers are just part of the used to be part of the fabric of life in a community. And one of the main things that people do when they pick up a is look at that cartoon. It's part of the routine of how people get themselves in the day. And it's that 10 to 15 seconds. They may or may not have lingered over those words that Rick and I slaved over. But Tony, But Tony, you know, it took 10 to 15 seconds to take in a very profound message that he would come up with. And it's just part of the habits of people in a region. So he's worked into people's daily lives in ways that maybe writers aren't.
Are you saying that one cartoon is worth 1,000 words?
of yours, right?
But it didn't take Tony 10 to 15 seconds to draw a cartoon.
No.
This was...
You know, early on in his career, when he started doing cartoons for alternative newspapers in Los Angeles, he was doing one a week, and he loved it. Oh, he so loved it. And he finally worked up the nerve to go in and see Paul Conrad at the LA Times, three-time Pulitzer Prize winner. And Conrad starts looking at it, and Tony said, you could tell that he thought they weren't bad. You know, it was sort of his shoulders relaxed, and he says, you really like doing this work. He says, yeah. He says, you get up every morning and you think of something else to put in the drawing. He's like, yeah. He's like, you need to do more cartoons because these cartoons are too labored over.
Oh.
And you need to do more work because it needs to look like you read the paper, you got mad at something, you sat down with your cup of coffee, and you dashed off a cartoon. And, you know, Tony was always looking to get more spontaneous, to find that sort of moment where you can't put your finger in the wrong place.
Let me play another clip from the interview I did with Tony Auth a couple of years ago. I think speaking, David, right to what you just said, let's listen to this.
I used to intellectualize a lot and sit down at the drawing table sort of already knowing what I was going to draw, at least to some extent. Lately, and by that I mean the last 5 or 10 years, I sit down not knowing what I'm going to draw at all, just the subject, and I just start drawing. And a cartoon emerges, and it's a much more organic process.
Sound familiar?
Very much so. He was letting the subject tell him what to do necessarily instead of, you know, trying to get it across didactically.
And then you might come in a few hours later, and this is the part of Tony's discipline. He would be at his little drawing board, his little draftsman's drawing board, with headphones on, laboring over the final draft of that cartoon with each line the way he wanted it and so forth. And he would just focus laser-like on it. This is after the idea and after the inspiration. These were finished works of, you know, cartoon art.
Chris, you want to say something?
I remember walking through the show that David put together with Tony at the Michener, sort of holding my breath because there was one cartoon I really wanted to see there, because it was the result of one of the few smart decisions I made while at the editorial board. One thing we did with Tony in later years when we were working together at the paper was we broke him out of sort of the ghetto of the rectangle that a cartoon usually went in. I said, Tony, you got an idea? It can be any shape or any size you want. And he did this extraordinary cartoon during the City Hall scandal with John Street, which is sort of a cross-section. It's almost like, what's the David Macaulay, the guy who does the cross-sections of ships? It was that cross-section, a Macaulay-like cross-section of City Hall, showing you all the things that go on. And John Street was there as the piano player who sees
it. It looked like a brothel or something.
Yeah, but it was very much like a brothel.
Whatever
but
that is.
It was 16 inches deep. Instead of having editorials that day, we just had Tony's cartoon. And to me, it was one of the most memorable things we did together. I was so relieved that it made the cut for you, David.
Well, I don't want to ask the favorite cartoon question because that doesn't seem quite fair. But is there one to you, David, that's one that you just feel like will stay with you?
I got it down to 150, and I feel very good about that.
You should.
But here's one cartoon that I can't say it's my favorite, but it will always make me think of Tony. So in my work, I'm often get close to artists, and of course their corner of the realm is their art, and people want to give me things, and ethically I'm not really allowed to take them. And Tony wanted to give me a cartoon, and I demurred, but I could tell he really wanted to give me something. And one day we were looking at it, we bonded early over Bob Dylan, and there was a cartoon of Gorbachev singing "Times They Are Changing," but completely about perestroika. And we were looking at it and we were laughing about it. And he could tell that I liked it. And he says, oh, you want that one? And I said, well, you know, it's pretty nice. He says, oh, I'm sorry to say I know where that one is, the person who has it. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. A couple weeks later, I come to his house and he's got that frame. He's got the piece all framed and everything. And I said, well, I thought you. This was at someone else's. You know, it was in someone else's collection. And he said it was. I called them up, and he actually didn't tell me. Actually, I met the woman later, a great friend of his, and she said when Tony had said that that I'd really wanted this cartoon, she gave it to him, and he, you know, he wanted to give it to me. I mean, that was that, and it was signed to these other people. And he says, "Oh, you should just cover that up with a mat or something." I said, what are you talking about? That's the great part of this, that you gave it to somebody else who he really loved. I mean, really, really loved. And that he would get it back so he could give it to me. I was just touched in a way that few things touch
me. Yeah, it's a great story. Do you have one, Rick?
We're well, I mean, I have a lot, but there is one that I've seen reprinted, and it reminded me of the old days when there was a great grain deal between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Because their crops had failed. And, of course, then we didn't have feed for our cattle. Meat prices went up. But it has – I don't know whether it's Brezhnev or one of the – was it Brezhnev? Standing in a wheat field in Iowa singing America the Beautiful. and that was one of his Pulitzer –
That's in the Pulitzer citation.
Entries. Yeah. And that's a perfect example of his –
Well,
this
is sort of shamelessly mentioning a special project Tony and I did, but for years we did a Christmas story together.
Yeah.
And the second last one we'll be able to do together was one he really liked. He really liked the story, and it was about an old homeless guy and a young woman who befriended him. But at the end, the homeless guy isn't really able to accept the friendship. And the last scene is on Christmas Eve. He's sitting over there in Franklin Square, you know, a couple hundred yards from where we are right now, staring at the stars. And he just... he loved that story, and he nailed that drawing just unbelievably. I have it up on the wall, and that's one of the many I'll remember him by.
Well, Chris Attullo, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Rick Nichols, thank you very much as well. David Leopold, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Tony Off for all the great cartoons and friendship and colleagueship as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about this program, but even more, go to the Newsworks website, go to Tony Off's blog, and you can see his work, and you can see many tributes as well. Also, you could go to the Philadelphia Foundation, 1234 Market Street, and an exhibition of Tony's work is there called Frontlines. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Quinn Lipson, our, what is she? She is our intern for the fall. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.